Well, this is our second conversation.
Yeah.
How have you been?
I've been doing pretty good.
Good, good.
Yeah. Last time I was going to try writing a novel.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't work out so well.
Why not?
When I started writing, after a few days, it was so monotonous and I just started to hate it almost immediately.
I can relate. I often try to write longer projects, and I don't know if that kind of work is in me, but we'll see.
Yeah.
So what kind of things are on your mind today?
Well, I was just kind of going to share my Jordan Peterson kind of journey, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds wonderful.
So I was, before discovering Peterson, I was doing my degree in engineering. Mm-hmm. But I eventually learned that I didn't think that would be the best for me long term. Mm-hmm. So I stopped doing that. And then I discovered Peterson, like many other people, on Joe Rogan's podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I remember kind of the way he spoke kind of perked my ears up. And I never really heard someone talk like with that. I don't know what you would call it, but it just seemed like what he was saying, he really believed what he was saying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a lot of conviction.
Yeah. So then I started watching his lectures, The Maps of Meaning, and then quite a while later, I watched the Personality lectures.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea what caught your attention, you know, on Rogan, you know, that first interview? He went through a lot of the C-16, politically incorrect, free speech stuff. I mean, that was kind of the initial fronting. And then he kind of gave a window into, you know, quite a bit more of what was behind his thinking. So what grabbed you?
It wasn't really the political stuff that grabbed me at first.
Mm-hmm.
It was more his kind of the way he looks at things in terms of morality and responsibility and trying to take those, your responsibility on, and yeah. And so eventually I did his self-authoring.
Mm-hmm.
That took me quite a while, but I thought it was useful.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about yourself?
I'm not sure that I did the past authoring, and that was kind of useful to get things organized in your head. Same with the future authoring, it gets you to think about things you don't really think about when you're just going through your everyday routine and stuff. And so that helped me get it. It kind of helps you structure the way you're looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not as like fragmented and kind of all over the place. So it really forces you to order things out in a way that makes sense.
Okay. So you discovered Peterson, you looked at Maps of Meaning, while later you did Personality, you did this, the self-authoring program. How did that change you?
I'm not sure exactly how it changed me, but when I started like working on some of the things that I laid out in the self-authoring program, that helped me see the value in trying to get yourself in order. Mm-hmm. And I'd say really what was the most impactful from Peterson was when he talks about his daughter. I really find that resonates with me.
Okay.
Dealing with my condition. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I found that really speaks to me.
What spoke to you about that? With his daughter, he's pretty. Some people might call it unkind or not terribly gentle. Sounded like he very much instilled in his daughter a sense that don't imagine yourself to be a victim, or you'll have a miserable life.
Yeah, I think he's right though. I found that's what I needed to hear. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because if you start losing your character, then you don't really have anything left. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That was one of the things Solzhenitsyn talks about a lot. When you're thrown in the gulag and there's nothing else, your property's gone, your family's gone. If you lose your character, then you're lost completely. And that was also another thing that really helped me reading that book was it's probably the best book that I ever read anyways. Took me quite a while though, but
which book, The Gulag?
Yeah, the full version. A few weeks, and I was reading quite a bit. So,
but that's very interesting because The Gulag is a strange book. It's almost an encyclopedic telling of misery and tragedy.
Yeah. There's some other moments in it that are almost like narrative, though, too. Mm-hmm. And stories. The ones about the prisoners that escape and manage to stay on the outside for quite a while. Those really read like adventure novels, almost in some sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely lots of acronyms. That took me a while to
those Russians don't write terribly readable books for Americans. I used to always get frustrated with Dostoevsky and how many names can one person have?
And there's lots of locations. And
so it's interesting to me. It's interesting to me how what you say about Solzhenitsyn's work that really interests me. Given your condition, I mean, I think many of us just looking at you might imagine you're a prisoner. But there's no easy, if you're a prisoner of those evil communists, of Stalin, you have an identifiable perpetrator, which nicely yields a narrative of victimhood. And it's interesting that Solzhenitsyn basically won't allow that narrative to be so simple, even though it's clear.
Yeah, that's when he starts going through himself and understanding how is it that I came to be in this place and along with everyone else, what compromises or lies or deception led up to this point. And so in some sense, there's no escaping that somehow you played a role in all of this. And even once you're there, if you think of yourself as a victim, that just doesn't help you at all. That's my assessment anyways. And yeah.
It's you know, and I think I was this morning, I was watching the second part of Mike Nanya's. He's basically working with the hoax paper people and with Brett Weinstein telling the story of Evergreen. And it has a fair number of clips of the students in their outrage, cowing, condemning, attempting to intimidate. But to me, what comes through in there is, you know, the self-righteousness, the one-dimensionality of we are the righteous, you are the guilty, we will stand in judgment over you. And again, if you would imagine, well, if there's a clear-cut example of totalitarianism, certainly it has to be the Soviets. But even in that space, Solzhenitsyn examines himself to discover the complicity. It's a bold and deeply correct move. Highly unusual.
Yeah, I was just watching Peterson's conversation with John Anderson, the newer one that came out a few days ago, and one of the things he said was, if you're looking for two people to blame, and you have Stalin and Hitler to blame for your troubles, then it's kind of hard to not see yourself as a victim when those are the two people who are in some sense the reason why you're there, but also you played some amount of a role.
Why do you think we don't want to do that? Why do you think we want to exclude ourselves of responsibility?
I think just because it's easy.
It's expedient.
Yeah. It's the easier way to go with it.
Do you think people derive a sense of meaning in it?
Yeah. In some sense, it gives them an enemy to project all their negative or all their negativity on. Yeah. Allows them to project their shadow, basically.
Yeah. And you know, this stuff scales because you can apply it into political contexts. You can apply it into family conflicts. You can apply it into almost any non-harmonious relationship you have.
Yeah. I think Solzhenitsyn's quote about the line dividing good and evil is really that kind of puts all this into a package. And I also like the second part of the quote that you don't hear as often, which is, I don't remember it exactly, but it has something to do with, and who wants to destroy a piece of his own heart? And that's why I think it's easier to go blaming someone else instead of working on a part of yourself. And it's, I think the idea of destroying your heart also gets to the idea that it's painful to do that. It's painful to look at yourself and realize there's parts of you that have to go if you want to be a better person.
So I'm looking up, the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. This line shifts inside us. It oscillates with the years. And even within the hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. Interesting.
Yeah, there's a few different versions of it.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. And he was a pretty grumpy guy. You know, a while ago, I was, part of what's fun about writing sermons is that I get to play around with all kinds of different critters. So I read his obituary in the New York Times. Interesting fella. You know, even after, you know, everybody imagined during the Cold War that once he was able to move to Vermont, and which is a lovely, luscious state, that he would somehow be happy and praise America. But no, it wasn't about to do that.
Yeah. There's another interesting thing that I always remembered from the book. I think it was every year he would have a day where he would only eat what he ate in prison. As a kind of way to remind himself how bad things can get. He found that even after going through all of that torturous stuff, he still found that eventually kind of faded from his memory. So he needed every once in a while to remind himself what it was like so that he wouldn't forget. I think that's pretty terrifying to think about. But all the stuff that even after all that, he still got comfortable in his routine.
We're very weird creatures in our routines. And I know Jonathan Haidt mentions this in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, where if you have a calamity, you think you're devastated. Usually about 2 years after the calamity, you kind of return to an equilibrium. Same goes for people who have, you know, a windfall, like a lottery winning. 2 years after their lottery win, they basically register similar levels of happiness that they registered, that they had before. We acclimate and adjust. Our capacity to acclimate and adjust scales remarkably. It's a real interesting fact about us as creatures.
Yeah, I think that's also why Peterson is right when he says happiness shouldn't be our aim, because it's there one day and the next day it's where it was, has always been.
Yeah. So you had your goal of novel writing, and you've, I don't, have you set it aside or have you discarded it?
I still have it set aside, but I don't think I'll be returning to that.
Okay. So what are your new goals?
Well, I started writing poetry instead.
Oh.
Yeah. And with the poem, like, they could be a lot shorter, and so my patience doesn't get the best of me. Could get through a few poems quick, and then without feeling like it's taking forever and dragging on. But I felt like kind of got right to the meat of the idea.
So do you have them on a blog, or you keep them private at this point?
I keep them private at this point, but okay. I might put them on a blog or something in the future.
Okay.
I shared a few of them on this website, but where you basically trade critiques with other people.
Okay.
So I put a few on there, and I'm still writing more. But I'm not sure what I'm going to do with them yet. Blog might be a possibility.
Okay. Okay.
And then the other side of Peterson that interested me was the biblical stuff to some degree, and the morality in general. Found that the materialistic framework, there seems to be some holes, though, especially with consciousness and identity, and how is it that we have an identity if we're made up of molecules and cells and atoms and electrons. How is it that we unify those things into an identity or a person? How do we know what level of analysis we should be looking at if we're using the materialist ideas? And then lately on YouTube, there's been a lot of stuff about morality and objective morality, and how is it that we can come to a moral system through rational means alone? And so that the discussions about morality really interest me for some reason. I recently read C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man, and that's kind of summarizes a lot of these problems. And it was a short, really short book, so I liked it. Probably what I should have read first if I was going to read C.S. Lewis.
What did you read first?
I think I read his autobiography.
Oh, yeah. It's not his best book. A number of biographers. First of all, it covers just the first part of his life. A number of biographers have noted that Lewis, for being as smart as he was amazingly bad at sometimes basic data. So there's just a lot of stuff he got wrong in telling his own story. Lewis is an interesting cat.
one of your other conversations, I heard you bring up some biographies that were written by other people. Pretty interesting.
My favorite is written by Alan Jacob, called The Narnian. I think Alan Jacob has a interesting way into Lewis, and I think it's a very honest biography. Lewis is so beloved that many just fall down and worship him, which he would be horrified with. He was a frustrated poet. His first published book was one of poetry, and Lewis is interesting because, you know, Tolkien was a better fiction writer than Lewis. I think Lewis's great strength was that of an essayist. That was about the right length for him. And so Abolition of Man is basically three essays that are joined, but interesting critter.
Yeah. So I hope I don't have the same problem with my poetry, but we'll see what happens.
Well, Lewis was, I don't know how old you are. Lewis was a fairly young man when he tried his hand at poetry. But, you know, it's important to remember he also was part of this generation that survived the First World War. And that's, you know, that in and of itself has been an interesting study of the literature of the survivors of the First World War that isn't necessarily about the war, but just how that war shaped them. So, well, poetry, you know, I encourage people to share what you make. You know, obviously you don't want to share all, you only want to share what you want to share, but you know, share what you produce, because that which isn't shared and subsequently isn't discovered never has a chance to go out there and bless the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely plan on sharing it, but I'm just not sure in what form and what it's going to be about.
Yeah.
So I find I write some stuff that's about all these weird things that I'm interested in, and I don't think it would make sense to some people.
Yeah.
But some of the other stuff would be better to share.
So in terms of your application from Peterson's self-authoring, did you come up with a list of goals or a list of or a plan of sorts in terms of what you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, I had some goals, but I revised a lot of that since then.
Okay.
I kind of start with a few small things at a time and then build up from there. So I think the poetry writing is going pretty good. Pretty good. And there's some other areas that I'm working on. More with my character and trying to be a better person, which is very hard. Especially when you start to try to do it, it's a lot more difficult than you would think. To try and let even small things go, it's nonsense. Why do all these little things bother me, and how do I go about fixing some of those? And yeah, so I have a big list of things that I'm planning on eventually working on myself mostly, and I just spend some time each week reflecting on the progress that I made or didn't make and revising the way that I'm tackling certain problems. I found that when you reflect on it, when you reflect on a schedule of some sort, that really helps to keep things going forwards rather than doing something. I found the self-authored was, it's a lot of things to tackle all at one time. So I found sticking to like two or three things at a time was more beneficial for me anyways.
That sounds wise. Well, it's interesting how that fits into your praise of Solzhenitsyn's work. It's an interesting, no one has ever said to me before what you've said to me about Solzhenitsyn's book, at least not someone from who's living in, let's say, contemporary America. It really interests me how and why that book struck you the way it did with so importance, how it raised up your relevance hierarchy to the top.
I really like that book. I wrote an essay about it too that I didn't really share anything, but took me a long time to write it, and I did a lot of revising, and so I really found a lot of value from really having my eyes open while reading it. So I took lots of notes. I highlighted a lot of stuff and tried to condense it down in that essay.
Well, I'd encourage you to, I mean, if you decide you'd like to share this conversation, and I'd encourage you to, to share it publicly. There's another guy that I talked to. We haven't had an online, he hasn't, we've only recorded some of our conversations. I'm going to share that back to him, but he hasn't wanted to share any of our conversations online, but that I feel he's got a lot to share. And so I've really been encouraging him to work hard on those ideas and get them out there. We live in this amazing period that, you know, who knows if this period will last, but this amazing time when regular people like you and I, we can make stuff and share stuff, you know, without gatekeepers, in a way that is unprecedented in human history. I was just thinking, most of what seriously impacts civilization as it moves on is usually that which has been devoted to writing. It's something that will endure. And in the moment, we have zero idea today what 50 or 100 years from now will be considered important. And so my bias is just put it out there, because who knows? It might be that people who lived in relative obscurity a few hundred years ago couldn't have imagined who for generations into the future regarded as making the most important contributions. We see that all the time. So I just encourage you to keep, whether it's your poetry, whether it's your essay on Solzhenitsyn, whether it's the fiction, you know, keep working at it and find ways to put it out there. And even if nobody during your lifetime sees it, you don't know what upcoming generations will find helpful. And if you never get it out there, they'll never see it.
Yeah, there's plenty to probably start sharing more stuff in a few months. So
good.
So I'll probably do that. And definitely very interested in kind of this intellectual dark web stuff. Mm-hmm. It's been going on YouTube, and that's pretty much how I spend most of my time.
Mm-hmm.
Writing my poetry and watching the videos and reading lots of books. And so if anyone watching who'd like to discuss it, I'd be open to that. Because I don't really talk to that many people. I'm a little bit of a hermit, but I have been talking to Adam, who you talked to a few times from this channel, and that's been good. We've been reading books and then discussing them, so that's been good.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, this ability to do this is really cool. it's really cool. So that's Adam from who has the Think Club.
Adam, he's talked to you twice, I think.
Oh, Adam Schellard. Adam Schellard. Schellard, who lives, who's the welder?
He's talked a few times.
Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, he is a sweet guy. He is a sweet guy, and he took an interest in my friend Freddie, who I haven't been able to do the Freddie and Paul show for a while because Freddie hasn't felt up to it. But I'm hoping Freddie can feel up to it at some point again soon. No, Adam is a good guy. So no, that's wonderful. Well, what, you know, part of the thing that, again, I've seen happen is that when I do conversations with individuals, you know, and I do post them on my channel, and people are, you know, I was nervous getting into this thing, how cruel the mob could be, and it certainly can be cruel, but most of the individuals who have dared to allow their conversations to be posted, I think have found a fairly warm welcome and level of support in the comments to the videos. Then I'll start getting emails from people asking, can you hook me up with this person that you talked to? I'd like to have a conversation with them. So it's vital. We need each other. We need to be affirmed. We need each other. It's just how we're built. So
yeah. I think that's been one of the good side effects of this Jordan Peterson blowing up and all this surrounding people and the smaller conversations have been one of the more interesting things to me than even the big stuff. But
what part of the country do you live in? I don't remember.
I'm from Canada, actually.
Oh, you're from Canada. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Eastern, Western, where in Canada? You don't have to be precise.
In Alberta.
Oh, you're in Alberta. Okay. 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 Oh, Canada. It's also been, I mean, Canada, Canada has less population than California, but partly because, of course, Peterson's Canadian, but it's been very interesting the how many conversation partners I've had from Canada through this. Very interesting.
Yeah. Clarence actually grew up in the same town as Jordan Peterson.
Really?
Yeah, in Fairview. So I thought that was kind of strange when I figured that out.
Yeah, if my father had made different choices, I would have grown up in northern Alberta. My father, when he finished his seminary training, he had in the Christian Reformed Church, we call them calls. He had two calls. One was to Paterson, New Jersey, which was the call he took, and the other one was there was a little joint, Barrhead and Westlock, I think, shared a ministry, or there were two churches that would share a pastor. And that was the other call he had, except the woman that he was engaged to was from the East Coast, the American East Coast. So he took the call to Paterson and spent 36 years there. But if he had taken the call to Alberta, I suppose I would have been a very different person growing up in rural Alberta instead of in highly urban New York City area.
Yeah.
I think we seldom ponder the impact of the tiny decisions we make that impact how many others, even for generations to come. The world is an amazing place. We've got about 10 minutes left. Anything on your list that we didn't talk about that you'd like to get out there?
There's a lot of stuff on my list we didn't get to, but
that's probably my fault.
No, I just kind of let the conversation go where it wants to go.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure we can talk again if I find a slot, but.
Getting slots isn't terribly easy sometimes, so that's just kind of the way it's going.
Yeah, I didn't find it too bad last time.
So what's highest priority on your list that we didn't talk about?
Well, I was going to talk more about kind of the religious stuff in Peterson and how what I think about that, but. So I think Peterson, he got me to think about the biblical stuff and Christianity more seriously than before. I wouldn't say that I was a militant atheist or anything like that, but I didn't really think about it seriously. Because when you're just going through your days, you know, you just kind of push it to the side and say, oh, that stuff over there, that's just silly. Why would I look into that any further? But I think that's a mistake. So Peterson got me to think about that, like really think about it, and then I started seeing some of the problems, like I mentioned, with materialism, and I don't think it's a sufficient explanation for everything. And then I came across Jonathan Pigeot's work, and that added another layer to this isn't just silly stuff written by crazy people from the past. It actually means something, and it's deeper patterns that we miss a lot of the times because we have our modern materialist glasses on and we assume we know what they're talking about when lots of the times we don't really.
What how did that work in your head? Why did Peterson trigger that?
I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it made me take a second look and look into things a bit deeper. And then Jonathan Pichot really took it from there for the most part. I wouldn't say that the biblical series really, I found them interesting and a different way of looking at things, but it wasn't until I started watching some of Pichot's stuff that I really started to take it more seriously.
That's interesting. What about Pigeot's work then caught your interest?
I think it was more of the patterns that he talked about. They seem to permeate into lots of areas of your life. Like these ideas of, I think, what he calls time and space. And if you think about like dieting or just how the year goes, when you're kind of about a cheat day all the time and you're like, well, what is that about? It's kind of this idea of, I think, what he calls the meta space, where you have your order and your kind of principles that unite everyone. But within that, there has to be a small amount of chaos, or else the whole thing will. The chaos is going to come from somewhere, and if you try to get rid of anything that doesn't fit with your structure, then it's going to come back and just tear the whole structure apart because there's no room for that. And that's kind of the same thing with a scientific theory. You have a theory and it excludes too much of reality. There's only so far you can take it before a new theory has to replace it. It's kind of the same thing with working. If you work too hard and you don't take any breaks, you have no time for recreation. And it's not sustainable long term, then you're going to burn out. But if you have the other problem where you're not working at all and you don't have any kind of routine, then you're just kind of swimming around in chaos and it's really not fun. So I started to see that these patterns, they're not just like silly things, but they fit into a lot of areas that you don't really even think about.
Do you think we practice them but don't think about them, are not aware of them? And that it's when our practice gets disrupted, then we become a little bit more aware.
Yeah, I think lots of people fall into those kind of patterns without really thinking about it. It's kind of like a lot of the things we use in our language that we don't notice. Like when we say, I look up to someone, why do we say look up? then why do we say I'm looking down on these people? There's the pattern of the high and low that's there all the time, and we just don't really notice it.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, those kind of things are, and Jonathan has done a terrific job in highlighting those kind of things and helping us see what's built into our lives that we have no idea of. And yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. So then once you start seeing these things, then the next question is, okay, what difference does seeing those things in our life make? It certainly might give us a sense of awareness or attunement to that which we practice. But then again, I think something in our hearts makes us want to be able to employ the newfound knowledge towards other goals. I'm not quite sure we have any idea where that goes.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure where that was going, but
well, and if you get to the last chapter of The Abolition of Man, I mean, that's really what Lewis deals with in the last chapter of The Abolition of Man. It's once self-mastery gets to a level, you know, to use Dostoevsky, once we reduce ourselves to piano keys, then we the funny bit about that next turn is, who is the we that then plays the piano? Because the we itself is a construct. And that's when I listen to Brett Weinstein go talk about transcending our programming, I always have to pause and say, tell me what programmed robot is doing the transcending. And you get into a very interesting loop at that point.
How do you reprogram it?
Right. And who is reprogramming it? Who is the me inside that takes a step back from my evolutionary robot programming and decides I can do better? Well, what constitutes the source of that better? Well, again, then you're back to Lewis and The Abolition of Man. Lewis would say, well, what we're actually doing is moving towards the Tao and trying to sharpen it, move towards it. But then you're basically saying that the programmed assassin robot can do this sort of thing. That's an odd thing to say about a programmed robot. So it's that puzzle just keeps running round and round in my head, and I haven't really figured out how to.
It seems kind of circular.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you start using the word better, then you're making a value judgment. And if you don't have a value system, then what are you going to use to judge better?
Right.
And then you're back at the start again.
That's right. Well, Nolan, this has been fun, and thanks for signing up for another round. And as with last time, I'll send it to you, and we can decide what we want to do with it.
Yeah. So I think you could go ahead and post it if you want.
Okay. All right. I will take that as a yes. I'll send it to you anyway. And I'm trying to stock up my conversations so that my channel isn't completely empty when I'm in Australia. So maybe there will be a big dead pause. I don't know. We'll have to see. But I appreciate you coming on and talking to me. And be well. And yeah, start a blog, get it out there. And when you do, you know, send me the link. And I'll post it on this.
Sure.
All right. Take care, Nolan.
Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye.